Welcome to the Scottish Watches Podcast. We have a legend on the line with us today, and it's not James for a change, although he is here in the background. I was speaking to James, probably a couple of months back, and the idea came to me as we were talking, because he's always mentioning this person when he's on our shows. Would you like to speak to the world's greatest car designer? We've got Frank Stephenson here, and we could potentially line something up where he comes onto the show, not to talk about watches perhaps in their entirety, but to talk about design, modern design, and cars. And we all know that cars are a huge part of any watch collector, watch enthusiast life, because if you like engines, you like an engine on the wrist. So today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Frank Stephenson to the show. How are you doing, Frank?
Doing very well, Ricky. Thank you very much for inviting me. And it's always a pleasure to speak to like-minded crazy people.
You're in good company. You're in very good company. Yes. So we've also got James. He is here to chaperone us. How are you doing, James?
Dude, no one's here to listen to me. I'm just going to shut up and be quiet.
We are going to be asking story questions that you've told us to get confirmation or denial that these things genuinely did happen in the past. So you can just raise your hand or you can give us the thumbs down, depending on what we're saying. And we've also got Dave Sharp with us. How are things, Dave?
Always good, Ricky. How are you?
Not too bad. Got some sleep last night, although it was sunny yesterday in Scotland and then it was hailstones. It was quite an interesting experience.
Yep. Nothing ever changes there, does it?
No, nope, four seasons in one day. What more
indeed,
do you want?
Indeed.
So let's get off to the races, so to speak, and let's do the wrist check. Frank, you're our guest of honour today. I've already seen on Zoom through the camera what you're wearing, but tell the good listeners what you've got on wrist.
Well, it's a watch that I typically would recommend only using on the weekends or on a special event, but I've gotten used to wearing it pretty much on a daily basis. It's a Rebellion Predator Three Hands.
Right.
Not too sure how many people know about the brand Rebellion, but it's a good one. It's kind of like, I guess, I mean, you wouldn't compare it to a car, to a Ferrari or anything like that, but they don't do a lot of advertising. So in that sense, it is Ferrari-esque. They don't, those who know.
They don't need to.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, it's a very special watch. I've had it customized, I guess you could say. It's a very modular type watch. It offers a lot of customization possibilities to it. So the gentlemen there at Rebellion were kind enough to say, yeah, just go crazy on it if you like, and what we can change, we'll change for you. So some of the components are a bit, I wouldn't say different, but graphically quite different than what you would normally buy off the shelf.
Okay. You're a bit humble there. Tell us a little bit more about what you've changed on it, because that's what listeners want to hear.
Well,
show us the damn watch.
I don't have it on, really. So if I just pull it off.
Here we go.
Yeah.
There'll be pictures in the show notes, people. You'll be able to play along.
Yeah. So we've got basically, I orange is one of my favorite colors. I've had to introduce that somewhere. And with the company I've started, pretty much the light black, unless you want to call it dark gray, is one of the other colors that I use. So it's using that combination. You can see on the honeycomb face, like I said, it's very modular, almost layered, which gives you a lot of that possibility of customization. It's very thick, but it's a 48 millimeter.
A lump.
You can see, oops, there we go. You'll probably be seeing it in reverse, yeah. But yeah, the honeycomb is half orange, half black. Those orange bits are added on. I've got it orange very delicately on the top half there.
Oh, yeah.
The back is not really customized, but what is customized is this side here, say FS edition.
Ah, nice.
It's very nice. If I lose it, I'll know it's mine. So no, it's very heavy, which I love. I don't really like small watches. I've got a fairly large wrist, and unless I can feel the watch on my wrist, that's the only way for me to feel like I've got something
there.
On. Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Brilliant. Well, it's a brand that maybe a lot of people, like you say, don't know, but they've got similar design ethics and things that I've seen with Richard Mille, different brands like that, sort of high-end Hublot, and they've been at Baselworld a few times. I'd seen them exhibiting there back in the day when that was a thing, and they sponsor motorsport. Is it Le Mans or something like that?
Yes, they run an LMP, I think it's LMP2, might be LMP1, right. But they're very successful, and they carry the livery and the branding on the vehicles, so they're very much into motorsport.
Have to get in touch with them.
Yeah, it's cool.
Didn't Bruno Senna drive for them for a while. I'm not sure if he does anymore, but
yeah, I think Rebellion was one of the sponsors of the cars he was racing. It went sort of the other way around. but yeah, they're still, I mean, they're heavily into motorsport, endurance racing, FIA GT type races. And so there is a little bit of translation of that design language of technology, high tech and everything into the watches. There's probably nothing on the watch that you would see as carryover from another brand. So it's pretty unique if you look at it.
Yeah, excellent.
Just to establish the design hierarchy here, I actually contacted Rebellion a couple of years ago, seeing if they were interested. And they're like, Mr. Thompson, no.
Goodbye.
So tell us more of your custom fantastic piece.
James, that is one thing I kind of miss on it. The illumination part on it really doesn't exist. You know, it's one of these watches at night, you don't know what time it is. You kind of miss that sometimes.
Yeah, see?
So that's
the world needs James.
Needs that in.
And the world needs to know what James is wearing on the wrist.
James is wearing the MW & Co. Asset 2.3. A name that just rolls off the tongue.
I was going to say, it sounds like a printer.
Yeah, straight out of the Hewlett-Packard naming book.
Oh, Frank is getting points on the scoreboard.
No.
This
That'd
is
be
a very
hard to repeat, James. I don't know.
The brand is called MW & Co, and they're a small brand out of Toulouse in southern France. And what's really cool about Toulouse is it's where Airbus is from and has all their development and manufacturing there. Mm-hmm. And the European Space Agency does all their development of all their satellites and such in that it's called the aerospace belt from sort of Toulouse to Burgundy, which is where most of us think of, you know, being the wine areas. So there's all the subcontractors around there. There's all these spectacular micro engineering companies and CNC places that'll just blow your mind. And so a bunch of the guys at this company, you know, if you're from Toulouse, kind of like Volvo being from Gothenburg, where I am, everybody's had a brother, a sister, an uncle who's worked for these companies. So the manufacturing capacity these guys have is just ridiculous. And we've just released yesterday what's called the Asset Black Badger Edition. That's something that we're sort of in pre-order stage right now. And it's all over my Instagram. I won't sort of flag it too badly all around here, but it's the coolest thing you ever seen, and it's much cooler than Frank's watch.
Good, good.
Same color
scheme. And a loom works.
James, is this a low volume limited edition watch, or is it
10 pieces? 10 yes. Pieces. Nice.
Yeah. Low sales volume if you're involved.
That's right.
It sounds like a watch that you have to choose the buyer, James, isn't it?
Pretty much. I'm just running up and down the street yelling at people.
Yeah.
No, it's cool. It's only 10 pieces.
Wow.
So a very, very small series, which is quite cool, actually, because that lets you really sort of take the gloves off and just kind of go apeshit crazy with stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're trying to go crazy with like what's a much higher production, I'm always hacking on Rolex. No offense against Rolex, but you know they make 50 billion watches a year. Mm. You sort of can't get away with doing that kind of stuff. So these really small, weirdo outsider brands, I just absolutely gravitate towards.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Dave, you're going to close your fucking door.
I've already shut two doors. The dog's just eating the mailman, but hey, what can you do? I am today wearing my Moser Streamliner.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is absolutely,
I love the
just so good.
Is that, Dave, is the green on the green is an upcoming trend now. I know it's that looks like
that
green going to black.
That I started. That I started.
James. Of course you did, James.
Yeah, you invented green.
The GOS watch, just a sec, pardon me, Frank. The GOS Damascus watch that you louts were saying looked like a peppermint patty wrapper or something like that. That came out like at least 20 minutes before every other watch in the world released green dials. So
This when was it? I think actually was this. I can't remember. I think this was last year. It was announced 2020. I think it was a 2020 announcement. This watch, the greens. It's like a Fumi green dial, and it definitely has it's almost black on the kind of minute track round it, and it kind of goes in. They call it matrix green because they took kind of the color idea came from that digital rain that was coming on the start of the Matrix films. That kind of green text that fell down. That's where they claim that kind of thinking from. But I just love the kind of it's almost verging on organic, the bracelet, in terms of
reptile-ish.
Yeah,
almost,
absolutely.
It?
It's that kind of
it's like nice. Geiger from Alien.
Yeah, it's almost it's that kind of like hard shelled like crustacean almost as well, plates that go up against each other.
Like the back of a lobster.
Kind of like an articulator. Yeah. Armadillo.
Yeah.
It's just a, you know, it's for
T-Rex.
Yeah, for me, it's a kind of, from a design perspective, this watch is, a few friends were talking about it, and what we kind of came up with was that it's actually the watch as a piece is more than the sum of its parts. You know, the bracelet's really great. The shape of the main watch is great. The dial's great, but it just, when everything's together, it just seems to be a bit more than any individual part of the watch. And for me, certainly, I always think that's a great piece of design, is when you can see great parts in something and you think, okay, that's really nice. But then you look at another part and you go, oh, that's horrible. When you can get something that the whole package just is more than the sum of its parts, is when you hit that kind of that little golden part.
I think also what works really well, David, is when the watch itself goes with the watch band. You know, a lot of times you see people that want to personalize and they use a band that has almost nothing to do with the watch itself.
Yeah.
And so that contrast is a bit harsh. It's kind of, you know, they're not speaking the same language kind of thing. But I like it when the watch band looks like it was designed to go with the watch itself. But the one thing that almost still gets me, and I'm working on a couple, or I'm actually three watches at the moment. I'm trying to find a new way, or we have found it, but to actually integrate the crown into the watch itself, into the case, such that it doesn't poke. I mean, you're wearing the watch on the other wrist, right? So it doesn't really poke into your, But if you can imagine that you don't have it poking out, I mean, mine is pretty chunky there, and I'm always feeling it. And I was always thinking, if that was up, if you could get that to fit flush with the case itself, still manage to pull it out because you can work underneath and be able to grab it. But I think it will give you a much cleaner looking design. Of course, that is an element of design that you can go to town with and really make it look pretty interesting and cool too. But I guess it depends on the watch.
Like that one?
Yeah, that's very much like that.
Almost hidden.
Yeah, that's very.
I think.
So you would actually grab that from underneath, Ricky, to pull it out?
At the back of it. At the back,
there you
there's an inlet so your finger can grab the back of it.
Yeah.
And then it pops out. So it's almost flush.
Almost flush. Yeah. I'm working on getting it actually flush. So it's there, you see it, but it's absolutely in the same, integrated in the same shape as the casing.
They've done that before with a press in.
It pops out.
So it's almost like a clicker. It pops in and pops out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The only problem with that is, I think, is kind of waterproofness, isn't it? Because you can't get the screw down function on it. I think the only other one I saw, James, you'll remember the brand's escaped me for the minute. The one that uses the oil-filled watch and it's got the dials that move around.
Resonance,
and they use the case back. So the case back itself, there is no crown whatsoever, and you turn the watch over and you flick a lever up on the case back and you turn the case back.
Like the old Accutrons.
Yeah, it's such a cool piece of design. I mean, technically it's difficult, obviously, because there's so many parts, etc., but it's such a smooth, organic-looking watch that for that reason, it's such a cool piece.
I had played with a project that never went anywhere, but basically it was a watch that was to be used in a very sort of chunky work environment, potentially having gloves on or something. And instead of having to manipulate a crown, which is obviously sort of very small motor skills, you would essentially, it would be like a rotating bezel, and cranking around on the bezel is what would wind the watch. And we just thought we were the most clever people on the planet until somebody that actually knows watches says, you will just rip the movement in half. And this is the worst idea we've ever seen. So it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of us, most of us with a typical watch, we don't really even set the time. We take the watch off to set the time anyways. We don't do it while it's on the wrist. So if you're trying to get a very accurate setting to your watch, you're basically going to take it off your wrist and manually try to do something. So it doesn't really matter if the part you're going to adjust is actually located in an unusual area of the watch.
Yeah, nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, as far as health and safety goes, if you're in like a really beefy working environment, like on an offshore oil rig or something, you have no business wearing a watch in the first place while you're working.
Really? Why?
There's that.
Why don't they?
Well, I don't know. If you're in something like when I'm working in the machine shop here, it's not like I've got a watch on around all the sort of heavy machinery and spinning parts.
It's a snagging hazard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't get your
especially
watch.
Especially if it's a 25 kilogram watch like Frank has on.
No, but well, you know, when we in the factory, McLaren, I remember you have to wear things around your buckles of your, you know, your belts and wrists and everything else. So
that was so subtle.
Easy flex.
Absolutely.
Easy flex.
So,
Is it my turn to do a wrist check now?
I remember this time, Ricky. Come on. Unlike yesterday's recording, cool. I have remembered. So, Ricky, what are you wearing today?
Well, I was wearing, I've taken it off now to kind of show things a little bit more, but I'm being humble today because I don't have a Moser. So I've got, this is my Tudor.
Nice.
Fast Rider Ducati edition.
Uh-huh. Like the strap. Oh, Frank's going to like this one.
I changed the strap to make it more in tune with a racing theme. So it's a kind of rally style strap that with the concentric circles for the subdials, I thought it actually matched the holes and the color scheme looks almost OEM, looks better than the strap it came with.
How thick is that strap to get that much red? I mean, it's a pretty thick.
It's not too bad, actually. It's maybe 4 mil, 5 mil.
Okay.
Like a heavy padded strap, isn't it?
Yeah. Padded in the centre, and it was only about $10 off eBay, because you know what I'm like, I don't spend much money on the straps, it's always the watch that costs the dosh.
Yeah.
But I thought I'd wear this one today, because this is my only kind of motorsport inspired watch that I do have at the moment. I'm sure James will sort me out something in the future. So, we're already 15 minutes in, and we're already away to the races, talking about all kinds of different things. You've named drop McLaren, that is going to be a big talking point, because we've heard so many stories. Let's start with one just now. James was telling us about the time that security at McLaren weren't too happy with them. What happened there?
Thanks, guys.
James, is that the time we went for the walk and we went down that hallway where the very expensive McLaren was moving on its own?
Now, is there a statute of limitations as far as insurance claims go? Because this was about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago.
Yeah, probably five.
I was over at MTC several times for various undisclosed sneaky projects. Mm-hmm. And one of the first times I was over there, I was good enough to score what ended up being a 4-hour personal guided tour around every square inch of MTC with our esteemed guest here. Mm-hmm. And we're walking around and we're seeing all the cars, and here's all the hallway, the boulevard with all the F1 cars, with all the F1 trophies, just a spectacular environment. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the heart to tell you that I don't have a driver's license and I know absolutely screw all about cars, but it didn't seem like the right place to bring it up. And we're walking through this beautiful, pristine white hallway that looks like something that was designed by Apple. It's just the quietest, cleanest, no corner hallway. And I swear to God, Buddy here walks over and like hits an invisible panel on the wall and this door opens up.
Oh, yeah.
And we go into what must have been like deep storage or something. It was like that warehouse from the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark that just had everything. And so we're walking through here. And by this point, it's about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at night. So the place is dark and mostly closed. I'm walking around with the design chief, you know, so you sort of get some liberties.
It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk through and I'm looking at these cars as we're going past them. And you're like, that's Jenson Button's car. That's Niki Lauda's car. Like it was literally a chapel.
Ooh.
And as we're walking around, it's time to start heading back. And it was this long, long, long concrete hallway, long-term storage of cars. And Frank dropped his security card, which obviously we needed to get in and out of things. Now, there's not a single car in this building that sits more than a centimeter off the ground. And as kick in the pants luck would have it, the card drops and goes underneath, quote unquote, some car. So we're standing here looking back and forth at each other like a couple of potato heads, figuring how the hell we're going to get out of this place with our security card. And we're crawling around on our hands and knees around. It was like a Le Mans type
car. This was the F1, McLaren F1. Long tail with the golf paint scheme on it. So a very valuable car. We're talking.
We'll get to that. If you're going to hijack my story, you have to land it safely.
Good. Okay. You go.
Francis.
Okay. I'm quiet.
Fucking hell. So we're crawling around our hands and knees trying to figure this card. And Frank goes, geez, I wonder if there's an alarm on this car. And he kind of gives a bit of a hip bump. Okay. Nothing happens. And he goes, geez, I wonder if there's a parking brake on it. Give it a push, James. So I put a hand on the hood of this car and I just give it a little push and it moves backwards a couple centimeters. Okay, great. Push it back about half a meter and I can reach my card. So it's me on my own, hand on the hood of this car, hand on the side view mirror, and I'm just inching it back and forth and back and forth. Frank gets his card and the car is still moving a little bit. What we hadn't noticed is the hallway had a very slight curve to it. And now the rear tail of this car is, I shit you not, 2 or 3 centimeters from a concrete wall. So you sort of grab onto it and stop this damn thing. And I'm pouring sweat. We have a big laugh. Everything's fine. Everything's secured. We go out. And as we're leaving, I'm saying, Frank, I didn't recognize that car. What was it? And of course, it was the as you said, the F1
Longtail GTR. But that car, okay, I won't hijack the story, James. But you know that car basically doesn't have a valve. We're talking. Well, you can't really put. We know that the minimum is 20 million for that car. Yeah. The minimum. So it could be anything from 20 million plus, and that material of that car is pure carbon fiber, which means if it touches that concrete wall, it's going to crack somewhere, you know? So somebody's going to know about it.
And my sweaty, terrified handprint is probably still on
if
the hood of that
car. If anything ever happens to that car, James, your DNA is all over it.
I need to pull an Ocean's 11 and drop down from a skylight and just polish off the hood and then disappear.
That was a scary situation. I tried to keep my cool, James. Very nervous. Because you don't realize it was that, you know, that trick where it looks like a car is actually moving on its own down those, there's somewhere in America and States where it's an optical illusion. You look like the car is on a flat surface and actually it's not on a, it actually looks like it's going uphill, which is weird, but your car actually moves and it looks like it's going uphill, but it's actually the trick of the horizon. So I didn't know in that hallway where we were that the floor is actually it's angled by about a degree. It's not much, but if you push anything, it will tend to move. So
now I'm no engineer. Crazy. I'm no engineer, my good sir. But I would recommend a parking brake,
behind the
some
wheels.
Of those wheel chucks. It's have an weight, intern James, lay down behind it.
Added weight. Mm. You just need chalk blocks.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There's a place in Scotland that's similar to that as well, where if you get to it in the countryside and you park, it looks like your car starts to go up the hill by itself. Very strange.
Yeah, a few places around the world that have that illusion, I guess.
So MTC, that's McLaren Technical Center?
Technology Center.
Yeah, that's the place that's got its own lake that kind of, it's an ecosystem in itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does that, Ricky. It uses the water from the lake to cool the building on the inside, but also to cool the aero tunnel, which runs up a lot of heat. A lot of the electrical departments need a lot of cooling, so they use that from the lake. It's a real, like you said, a real ecosystem. The building is amazing. I mean, well, first of all, you have to come into the building, and that in itself is an experience. If you come in the way the employees have to come in, you basically have to go down one or two floors. As you come in from the parking lot, you take a glass cylinder elevator. It's kind of like a piston within a cylinder, but the piston's transparent. Go down one floor, then you walk through a long white tube with actually nothing on it for about 50 yards or 50 meters. And you can't see the source of light. There's nothing on the walls. And it's purely there to purify your thoughts before you get to clean out your mind, before you get to your workstation. Then when you get to the end of the tunnel, you take another elevator, it takes you straight up to the floor you're working on. And your first view when you come up to the actual environment where you're working is of that lake in front of you, that beautiful, beautiful scenery out that way. Yeah.
Have you never been to MTC, Ricky?
I get invited by Kenwood back when I was working with some car magazines.
Oh, you have seen it.
It was a combination because I think Kenwood were running the telemetry systems and all the rest of it, communication gear. So it was 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. And it was like going into a spaceship. Yep. It was like 2001. And you walk in and everything is pristine. There's not a speck of dust. It's a surgical environment. Mm-hmm. And I think this was when the SLR was either just coming out or come out. Mm-hmm. And we got to have the full tour. Well, not the full tour, but the tour they allowed us on. And they took, back then, camera phones had only just been invented. So it was like Nokia 7250Is with shit quality. But even at shit quality, they said, turn your phones off. Don't take any photos. So obviously, I'm right here and around there getting everything I could. So I've got some really shit low-res images that I'll put in the show notes. And then at the end of it, the photographer came out, took a big photo of the full of the, because it was like fast car, Redline, Max Power, all the sort of modified car boy racer magazines that I was working with at the time. And it was just an amazing experience. And that was 2004. I can only imagine what it's like now, because back then it was way in the future.
Such a spectacular building. We should actually see if I'm probably allowed to post the picture by now. This is my Frank Stephenson anecdote number two, if I can segue.
Okay.
There's the coolest picture where I'm standing on the balcony over top of the MPC, McLaren Production Center, so the factory of all these things. So on this tour where we're walking around looking at the entire facility, we just about ruined a car that would probably have me killed and thrown in the lake. We get to the top of the factory and Frank's like, hey, does your phone have panorama mode? an iPhone. I think so. He goes, I'm going to take the coolest damn picture of you. So he has me go stand in the balcony and look as cool as I can. And sprawling behind me is the entire production facility with the P1s. And I think it was the 570, yeah. Which was just coming out.
Yeah.
And of course, Frank says, this is just a fun picture for you to have. Don't post this on Instagram. Don't put it on Facebook. You know, they'll have us killed. Ferrari would pay a fortune for it. And so, of course, I don't post it anywhere. But when I get back home to Sweden, you and I were chatting. And I think you said, hey, can you email me that picture? I'd like to see it. So I emailed you the picture. And then I don't know if you were traveling or something. But I think like your assistant opened the email. And then suddenly this giant poo storm starts. Because I guess somebody who has no idea who I am is going, who the hell is this guy walking around the bloody McLaren factory popping off pictures and, you know, like mugging for pictures with the P1 prototypes and all this kind of stuff. And I think it was you were on your way to Singapore or something where you were in transit for a while. And for a full 24 hours, I literally thought I was never going to be allowed again. I thought I was going to be sued. I thought I was done because I've got a couple friends that work in different departments there. And they were like, I, this is the God's honest truth. Dave and Tom, they were like, dude, I hear yelling upstairs and I keep hearing the words Sweden and James. I was bricking it for an entire day.
Well,
then finally Frank comes back, finds the email and goes, oh yeah, no, it's fine. I took care of it yesterday.
Yeah.
And I must have sweat out 80% of my body weight.
I was probably sweating too, James, with this behind the scenes stuff going on. Like, why did you let him see all of that? You're not supposed to take anybody over into that area. But yeah.
Do you know who he is? That's James Thompson, the finest living designer. Good Lord, what have we done?
No.
Exactly.
But you know, James, I'm the most uncorporate employee of out there because I really refuse to go by the rules. I mean, it might be the designer approach, but it just irks me that you know that marketing, communications, and PR and all those guys treat our places as like the holy, you know, the holiest place in the world when it's just an area where we're just trying to develop cars and make them really, really nice for people to get excited about and who are passionate about cars. And okay, you didn't come across as being a real car guy, James, but it's nice. I could see how your face lit up.
You know, you mean when I arrived by the bus?
Well, yeah, but you know, the things like the
skateboard,
the cafeteria, right? Where the pressure, I was telling you, remember the pressure in the cafeteria where we eat is lower than the pressure outside the cafeteria. So everything is in glass there, basically you see through the building. But the glass doors on the cafeteria, when you open them up to go out, the air comes rushing in so that you don't get the smells of the cafeteria going into the working environment. You know, it's that pressure drop. So a lot of cool details in that building that are...
What was the thing about the floor tiles? You were telling me something about the floor tiles, how there's not one single floor tile in the entire building that had to be cut. They're all the exact same...
They had to...
Somebody did the math.
Yeah, they had to readjust one huge wall of MPC. It was already up. You can imagine this factory with about 100 meters long wall had to be taken down and re-put back up because the tile would have meant adding a half of a tile or a third of a tile to reach that wall. So they took the wall down and moved it slightly just so that it wouldn't have to have that little sliver of tile in there. And I remember the big boss, Ron Dennis, who was the head of McLaren for a long time, when they were installing the urinals in the building, it had already been all done. You know, every floor had, I don't know, five or six bathrooms and things. But he went through them and he noticed something that made them have to rework all the urinals in the building. Because after they had them all installed, he's like, why did the guy who's sealing the urinals to the wall start the seal at the top and not underneath? Because I can see where it starts at top dead center, you know, 12 o'clock. Why didn't he start underneath? And they're like, oh, doesn't really matter, does it? Said, yep. They had to unseal all the urinals.
Sounds like my kind of guy.
All over again.
That is.
Yeah. If you're OCD, kind of guy. That was the place to work. I used to not want to admit it because it just seemed like when you're growing up that way, that it's just the wrong thing. It just seems weird. You think it seems weird, but I'm as OCD as it gets. My family, my father was as extreme OCD as you can imagine. I mean, I can't imagine anybody being more over the top than my father, and it just rubbed off on me. And so when I went to McLaren to work, knowing that Ron himself was like that, it felt like I was coming home to work. You know, it felt, I understood him. We got along really well. But yeah, it's fascinating to work in a place where nothing is good enough. And you have to, you know, even if you think it's good enough, it's still not good enough. So
it reminds me of a story about a guy here in Glasgow that ran a place called Drivers. His name was George, did some work for him back in the day. Uh-huh. And this was before, around about the Fast and Furious time, where modified cars just kind of, everybody was right into that. And when he got his new place designed, Dave, you probably know it, it was St. George's Cross. And when everything was installed, he went round and told the people that were fitting places out that all the screws in the light switches had to be perfect 12 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was a story that just went through that. The slots had to be absolutely bang on. Yeah. So that attention to detail, it's something that, you know, we all appreciate.
Yeah. I actually had that job for part of a summer on construction sites in Vancouver. As soon as they found out that I was like a design student, they're like, okay, well, your job is to go around to all the finished penthouse suites with a little tiny screwdriver and make sure all the screws and the light switches were lining up.
Wow. So Ublo, if you're listening, this is a guy to speak to.
In design, when we're designing cars, you can mathematically design it correctly and it looks wrong. But if you do it to your eye and it feels right, then who cares what it measures, you know? It just feels right. So there's a lot of times when we have to design things, we're working on the clay model and you do it to what you think is the scientific method of designing something and it just looks off. So in that sense, if it looks right, it is right. You know, forget the numbers.
I'm quite into cars as well, but I'm also very into aviation. And it's Frank Kelly from Lockheed Skunk Works, who designed the Blackbird, but also designed the U-2 and designed early stealth aircraft like the F-117. And they used maths to design that aircraft to defeat radar. And the only problem was it was genius in that it had such a small signature on radar. The only problem was it didn't fly. So they did all of the science and said, yep, perfect, we've got the aircraft. The only problem was it couldn't stay in the air. So they then had to spend billions of dollars on software to keep it in the air. So it just shows, you know, and his argument in his book always was, if I'd designed that, it might not have been quite as stealthy, but definitely would have flown. And he said, on the basis that we're designing an aircraft, that's kind of the whole point, you know, and it just shows you, doesn't it? It's like, you know, that's getting that mix of humanity and science.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. Frank, if I can ask you a question.
James, can I ask some fucking questions on my own show?
Whose show is this?
38 minutes in with an hour show, I haven't even got the guy to start talking about what he's done in life.
That's what I'm asking him.
That's all
right. Ask Frank how he gets started in the business, James. Come on.
No, ask anything, James. Go ahead. Shoot.
But I was asking about your sort of approach to shrink wrapping design, as you call it. And McLaren is such a performance product, and from a designer perspective, what sort of balance and contrast is there between trying to make something that looks sexy as hell and something that also has the performance that it needs to have?
Yeah.
Does one drive the other?
Yeah, I know. I kind of get the drift of the question. I know where you're heading with that one. But the funny thing is, you have to try damn hard to make a well-performing object look ugly. You have to try to make it look ugly. And believe me, a lot of companies do mess up the design of a well-performing vehicle. Anytime you have...
Can you name shame anybody?
Yes, I could. Still, I will get there as soon as I have a couple more sips of my trusty hydration fluid here. The thing is, what I was saying is this old adage, which I consider about as wrong as it can be, as anything can be, is form follows function. Form is function. It doesn't follow at all. If you're doing the game right, if you're designing in the right way, the form is a result, obviously, of the function. So if you've got great performance in something and you just design around that, you know, just package it, basically, you're going to have something that looks great anyways. I mean, that's what we see in nature. And I go on about biomimicry and the influence of evolution and nature and design, how it's the most intelligent source of inspiration for anything out there. But in nature, it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, I haven't found it yet, to find anything that performs extremely well to be what we would call unattractive. There's this link between beautiful function resulting in beautiful design. And that's the problem with a lot of, like I said, some car companies tend to put design at the forefront as okay, it works well, but let's just try this, try that. They're trying way too hard. And in this day and age in car design, you start to see a lot of that coming about where people are, the marketing departments are driving the design departments almost in the sense that they want to add. Whereas the truth about good design is it's about take away. It's how to simplify. And that's not to say that you're going to design a boring project. Good design is not boring. And simplification doesn't mean boring design. It just means intelligent ways of eliminating things that you don't need. And what you said earlier, James, about shrink wrapping, that was in the search of reduction of weight. You know, if you're doing a weight is the enemy, as they say, in a lot of industrial design applications. So we try to eliminate unnecessary weight or optimize the less weight. So what you do with, when I came to McLaren in 2008, there wasn't really a history of previous car designs where we could say, okay, we'll build off of this building block and we'll develop a design language that we can sort of evolve over the next few decades. You have to start from zero, which is what every designer dreams about, the chance to start a product or a company with that kind of power of the brand of McLaren, starting a design language for them is as good as it gets. But it's also obviously a lot of responsibility, but you don't want to use existing influences from other car design companies, because then you'll get, you know, it happens a lot with some companies, you'll see parts of the design have been reinterpreted from some other company, and it's kind of like mm-hmm. piggybacking, and you don't really get the clout, I think, of coming up with an original design. When I started with McLaren, the only car that we really had that we could say is a true McLaren, and not even that, because the engine wasn't even from McLaren, but that was the three-seater, the F1. And that car, designed by Peter Stevens, engineered by Gordon Murray, and became now is probably the supercar of ever, you know. It's still valued. It's valued more today for what it is than when it was even first out. But that car was basically not really designed. It was just packaged. The engineering was just packaged. So it's so far back in the McLaren history that when I started, roughly 15, 20 years after that, I guess you could say, the objective was not to carry over that design language, but create a design language that could stand on its own and compete with the brands that have existed in that market forever, like Ferrari, Lamborghini, Porsche, all those guys. But the one thing they had never done was design purely for performance. And when I started, I thought, okay, clean sheet means we can pretty much design anything, but we're starting with an excellent package. Obviously, the mid-engine, the carbon tubs, low position center of gravity, very minimal overhangs. They kind of set up the direction you're going to go to. But the surfacing has to be aero efficient, absolutely, in a car like that, because that much power, you want the car to stay on the ground. So aero comes into the equation. So what you have to do is not think of designing a car. You have to think of managing the air, managing air, principles of aerodynamics. And so that's what started turning me, although I have this fascination for biology for a long time since I was a kid, I thought, well, just pick out the fastest things in nature and how are they designed? So if you start looking at, you know, peregrine falcon or cheetah or sailfish, which are typically the fastest animals in their respective environments, you'll notice that they're all shrink-wrapped. So there's no excess of material on the body of these organisms, these animals. And what they do is basically suck out anything that doesn't need to be there. So they kind of, they're not skinny, they're just minimalized. And so that was the design language we tried to capture with McLaren, where everything that didn't have to be there was gone. It was either turning into a hole or into a vacuum packed type of skin. Whereas if you look at Ferrari, it's kind of like, you know, the sexy mama, you know, the kind of sensual, the MILF, right? Kind of, or even, but you can basically wash a Ferrari for, 5 hours and still have a pretty stiff, whatever. But it's just kind of the surfaces are going the other way, right? They're full, they're sensual. with McLaren, it was like, let's go the other way. Let's stick it in the gym and get rid of all the BMI, the body mass index, and reduce it. So we did that, and the car got its own look because we tried to suck the air out of it and minimize everything. Very much like if you took a bed sheet and lifted it over the package. So you have your components that have to be there, the seats, the engine, wheels, suspension mounts, everything that has to be there. And then you have what we call hard points. Those are the points you can't really move around on the car because they measure the height of the bumper, where the exhaust comes out, all those kind of hard points. You throw a sheet over it and let it just settle. And that became the shape of the car, of the P1, of our most extreme hypercar. And people say, wow, that must have been really difficult to design. It wasn't. It was just a given of taking out as much material as we could. And of course, the radiuses, little edges and things, you try to tune those to be softer or harder in certain areas. That's, I guess you could call the designer's touch, or the human touch. But apart from that, it's just basically minimizing surface area, and the car creates itself pretty much.
I don't know a hell of a lot about design, especially with cars and whatnot, but I've seen things to do with technology moving forward. And one of the buzzwords these days is machine learning, artificial intelligence. And I've seen computers design wishbones and certain things in a very organic, nature-esque way where only the component parts that are required are utilized. What are your thoughts on the way that those things are moving forward? Because that's taken away the human element a little bit more, but it's more in tune with nature, like you said, because it looks more organic.
Yeah, absolutely. We're able to do that now, Ricky, because of the advancements in production. We're using 3D printing now, which is allowing us to produce things that optimized. I mean, you know, we can't stay stuck in the past forever. We need to keep on top of development, innovation, just like doctors and, you know, doing surgery, they have to know the very latest techniques. Otherwise, we don't move forward. But in terms of production, on those elements that we're trying to minimize, the computer can basically figure out the design for you. It can tell you where you don't need material, where you should add material, and you basically produce a piece that almost, like you said, it looks like it's organic. It's I wouldn't say it's less human-like. It's actually probably more human-like in the sense that we are evolutionary creatures. We've been developed to basically have the best of the best. Otherwise, we wouldn't survive. You know, you have to be at the top of the food chain. Your organism's designed to do that in nature. So I think it's just an advancement. That is, for me, the future of design is basically taking that inspiration from nature and using it in design. It has its own look. It's not that each company basically has a unique look. I mean, anybody can borrow that type of inspiration for their products. It's not, nobody owns it. Yet there's enough variation in nature to give you a uniqueness to your design. You know, it's almost like saying, okay, all birds do the same thing. They fly, but not all birds look the same. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of maneuvering room to basically design your own design language within that inspiration.
Well, I've got a question from one of our listeners and a good friend for many, many years, David Pollock. When I told him you were coming on the show, he almost wet his pants, and he's not old enough to wet his pants naturally yet. Maybe you've kind of answered a little bit of it already, but here we go. He says, Frank, you have mentioned in some of your YouTube videos places where you have found design inspiration to solve practical problems, with the McLaren P1 mirrors taking design notes from the sailfish to solve wind issues, etc. Are there any unusual or interesting places as a designer you've looked for answers to problems, and how do you research these things? Do you therefore look at all things with an objective design-based view?
Yes, I do. I mean, the last thing I want to do is design something that is just another item that fits into the product range of what's out there. In other words, if I have the opportunity to design something new, should, in my view, bring something new to the game. It should innovate. It doesn't make sense just to design another thing for the market, because there's enough things out there that one more is not going to change anything. But the fun part of design, what I find fascinating about design, is that you're not an artist and you're not an engineer. You're sort of a blend of the two, because if it's art, really doesn't have too much of a purpose except for, say, visual or entertainment value. And pure engineering requires an element of the human touch to make it, say, attractive and appealing. We're just geared to like things that look good. So for me, the important thing is if I'm designing something, it has to innovate in some way, has to bring something new to the game. It doesn't mean it has to be the most expensive on the market, the product on the market, because it has nothing to do with cost. Good engineering doesn't have to cost a lot. It can be that's where innovation lies. But for inspiration, I do have to keep a very open mind and sort of keep educating myself as to what's out there and what can provide that type of newness or fresh thinking. The thing about designers is we never really grow up. We're still like little kids that are, you know, the typical child syndrome where you ask why, you're super curious. In a lot of professions, a lot of walks of life, you lose that curiosity as you're growing up. It just becomes not so important. But the best designers out there, I've always felt, are the people who are still kids asking why, even when they get, you know, into their older ages. So you have to keep that radar open to whatever's out there. For me, it's particularly it's nature, and now it's expanding into space. I'm really interested. I've always been interested in space, but it's becoming more accessible to us now, and it's opening a lot of new things. I'm currently working on two vehicles that are going to be sent to the moon at the end of this year on SpaceX, and they're going to be dropped off on the lunar surface, and they're going to have a race. So they're going to race each other on a track that's been designed. And those two vehicles are pre-development vehicles, pretty much for the full-size vehicles that will be going up later this decade. So you have to start something. But those two vehicles are opening up new questions, new design directions that we have to look at, which aren't so much influenced by, you know, aerodynamics or gravity, but more about the electronic side of the industry. I could talk about this one for a while, but it does get pretty crazy. We're replicating the surface of the moon on Earth.
So you're just reusing the sets that NASA used back in the 60s?
I could see him smirking, and as soon as I saw him smirking, yeah. I thought, I know where this is going.
You don't believe it, do you? Why was that flag waving?
Boy, the graphics were good in 1969. Like,
yeah, no, it's quite interesting. It's very breakthrough. I mean, it's going to happen. It's very it hasn't been talked about yet in the press too much, but it's going to be a cool way that we can all visualize on Earth, have cameras set up, and you'll be able to put on your VR goggles and watch the race from Earth. It's going to be a pretty cool thing.
A question I had for you quickly was, obviously a lot of what you've talked about, especially in these more modern high performance cars, where a lot of things like, you know, aerodynamics and necessity of performance is built into the design. If you look back at a lot of the kind of, how shall we call them, older real classic designs, whether we're going back to the, you know, older Jaguars or going back to, you know, personally my favorite car of all time in terms of aesthetics is the DS, the Citroen DS.
Oh, yes.
And obviously those cars were designed in a much more, you know, it was a slide rule era, if you want to call it that. So it was people, and you know, they didn't have computing power, the scientific knowledge of aerodynamics and, you know, 3D printing and carbon fibers. Mm-hmm. They were working with known commodities, steels, metals, maybe aluminium, that they were constrained in what they could do, and it was much more a design of the imagination. But I was going to say, do you agree that maybe some of that's been lost by it being taken over by computers and stuff? You know, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very clear that it's clear, for me, what we've lost is that romance of design, simply because, and it's not an excuse, it's just a fact, regulations, health and safety, everything has started to take over. And now we have to conform to a lot of rules, which is not a bad thing, because it's all in the promotion of safety. We need to be pretty safe in these vehicles, because, you know, otherwise you have a problem. But the need to conform to regulations has restricted a lot of the design freedom that they had earlier in the years when you could be basically you could be an artist almost to design a car. You didn't have to worry too much about maintaining certain rules, following certain rules. You had that freedom. That's why we have the concept cars to inspire us. So a lot of times what you'll see at a lot of motor shows is a company showing a thought, or at least a conceptual ideation of what a vehicle could look like 10 years from now. And they'll throw caution to the wind sort of thing, and produce vehicles that you look at and think, yeah, I wish. And then obviously when they say build it, and there's a lot of push from the public that that's a good direction to go in, they go back to the drawing board, find out that they can't actually build it. And when they do produce it, a lot of people complain, well, that doesn't really look like what you showed us that was so exciting at the motor show. Why? What happened? And it's basically rules that you have to follow for homologation purposes. So yeah, I regret it too. My love of cars, really, it's a very wide range of cars that I love. But I would say the modern day cars I love less than the cars I loved from the 50s and 60s, for example, when it was all about, I mean, the cars performed fairly well, but everything in this day and age, now we have cars producing 2000 horsepower electrically. And it's less now about how much or how fast your car can go or how many horsepower it can produce. Because at that stage now, it doesn't matter if you go from zero to 60 in 2 seconds or in 3 seconds. It's hard to tell the difference. So like I said earlier, a lot of marketing departments are starting to put a lot of the power into design to sell the product. And they're trying so hard that ugly is becoming the new beautiful. You know, it used to be accepted that a car was beautiful in the 50s and 60s. And now it takes you 6 months to get used to the design before you're kind of used to it. And it's not that you love it. It's just it normalizes itself. Yeah. Yeah. You get used to anything.
Every time I see one of the current model Civic Type Rs, I just think that used to be quite a good looking car. Yeah. And then they just put things on and it's like Knight Rider kit and Super Pursuit mode 24/7.
Yeah, it's a bit of a transformer looking vehicle. And they don't know where to stop. And the worst thing is the fake fence that you see, even on high-end car. Audis, for example, are probably one of the worst companies at doing it. They'll put on a sports car, they'll put fake fence. You know, it'll look like a vent. You walk up to it, no air goes in, no air goes out. It just looks like a vent. And that is terrible design for me, not designed for purpose.
Well, let's talk about some watches an hour and 5 minutes into our 1 hour show. I think the first time I saw you and your name involved in something was an episode of Wheeler Dealers.
Oh, yes.
Where they were talking about the Ford Escort Cosworth, and you had originally wanted three prongs, and for cost measures, they reduced it to two, and they brought it back, and they brought your influences into the car when they restored it. That was kind of the first thing. And then I'd seen the YouTube channel popping up, and because I've got this interest in cars and everything else, I was like, oh, let's check this out. And I watched quite a number of them. And obviously your figures have gone way up. You're nearly 150,000 subscribers, which is phenomenal. Mm. But with the watch side of things, there's not a lot out there about that.
Definitely is a connection between creative people, watches, cars, anything mechanical, technological. And watches have always been a part of my life. The first watch I ever had was an Omega Speedmaster that my father got for my graduation, and I had it stolen. It really upset me, and it was such a beautiful, meaningful watch for me. I mean, it was my father, who is part of the biggest person ever in my life, was my father. And to have something stolen for no reason at all, I had it, and I put it into a drawer at work, and I worked in an outside garage workshop. And they just walked straight in off the street, opened the drawer up, saw the watch, and took off with it. That was my very first nice watch, I guess you could say. And then from there on, I've always had watches. But when I started working, I started getting into the position where I could afford a better watches, I guess you could say. And the first one I got was if you remember Movado? They still exist, but they had a very designery feel to them. So it was just a black face with the gold dot at 12. Very sleek, very thin looking watch. I had that. The next watch I got was to celebrate having designed the new Mini. I gifted myself a Breitling Super Ocean, I think it was. And then I moved on to congratulating myself again. Why do we always buy our own watches, don't we? In Venice and picked up a Bell & Ross Big Date. So I had that for a long time, still have it. Yeah, I mean, all car designers seem to lean towards Bell & Ross for some reason, the aviation side of it, I think. And then I had one that was pretty cool from a design perspective, not a big brand. The brand itself is big, but wouldn't expect to own a watch from them. Oakley Gearbox. Oh, I don't know if you've ever seen that one before. It had a carbon face, and I don't know what it is. I lose all these watches. It's like losing your passport. I don't know how I do it, but...
You dropped it under a car.
Oh, I have no idea. Right. I can't find it. It's still there, isn't it?
There's a dude on Instagram, Greg Gutierrez. His Instagram is Maverick Workshop, and he was responsible for doing most of the physical development and prototyping of all this phenomenal range of Oakley watches.
Okay.
So he was the guy that actually figured out how to make everything, and how to sort of the amount of CNC and engineering that went into just the bracelets on these things. Uh-huh. You know, whether you like the final product or not, doesn't matter. But the amount of science and math that went into those things is just insane.
Great design department. Yeah, they were. And then probably some other watches in there too. But the next one I really remember is when McLaren was working with or sponsored with Tag Heuer. And we'd just done the very first new McLaren of the range, the MP4-12C.
So James' watch.
Your watch, James.
Rolls off the tongue.
MP4-12C is the first McLaren that came off the production line after I started. The first one I was involved with. MP4-12C, guys, this might be a little bit interesting. This
sounds like a fax machine.
Exactly.
Well, that was a modular microphone I was using.
MP4 is Marlboro, which people oftentimes think it's actually McLaren, but it's not. It's Marlboro Project 4. Project 4 was Ron Dennis's company before he started with McLaren. So they combined Marlboro with Project 4. You got MP4. Then the dash, and then the 12C. The C is for carbon, the element, because of the carbon tub and carbon technology that they were using. And 12, which nobody could ever remember what 12 actually meant, is the horsepower times the weight divided by the coefficient of drag times the CO2 emissions. That number would give you a number, and you would multiply that times 0.2, and it would give you 12. So nobody understood. It was kind of like the Coca-Cola formula. You know, nobody knows what it is. But that number came out to around 12. So Ron's idea was that's a good way to measure performance on a vehicle.
So have you been involved in the design of any watches or anything like that through your life as well?
Yeah. So when we did that MP4-12C, McLaren wanted to do a commemoration watch for it using Tag Heuer and their movement. So they asked me to design the watch for Tag Heuer. I can send you an image of that. It came out really nice. I worked really late at night for about a month. Me and Paul Howes, great designer from McLaren, we worked on it pretty long. And we came out with this limited edition to 1,000 pieces of a Tag Heuer MP4-12C watch that was selling for about, I think it was around £10,000. And it went fairly quickly off the shelf. But it was kind of fun because we could do pretty much anything we wanted as long as everything underneath was stock, you know, from the original Tag Heuer movement. And that was a good first introduction into how to, you know, combine the McLaren values, I guess, with a watch. It wasn't just a free-for-all. It had to feel like a McLaren watch. But then after that, as soon as I left McLaren, I got into designing eVTOL aircraft, which is going to be the new mobility, ways of mobility in middle of this new decade in 2024. These are flying taxis that are coming to the market, electrical flying taxis, vertical lift, takeoff and landing, autonomous shortly thereafter, as soon as we get our safety ratings and everything sorted out. While I was designing these eVTOL aircraft, I was contacted by a U.S. Gentleman who's responsible for Luminox, which is the U.S. brand, and he was or is interested in creating a new brand of watches, various brands, but one of them is a watch that pretty much we can start from scratch. Obviously, the movement exists, but the design of the watch was could be from scratch, everything besides the movement, obviously. So I've been doing that for the last 3 years, and the first watch, which you'll see this year, it's coming out, is the result. I couldn't believe, well, he can't believe it either, that we took 3 years to design a watch when it takes you a year max to design a car. It takes a lot of development time, but a watch that we spent 3 years designing, and that's down to how much detail we tried to perfect on it. It's not a complicated watch or anything like that. It's very, very simple, but the design of it, I don't think I could design something better than I've designed this watch. in terms of simplicity, clarity, designed for purpose, I guess, also. But I'm pretty proud of it.
All right. Well, listen, we are going to have to end the show because we've taken up far too much of your time already. But it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, not just to yourself, James, for organizing this, but Frank, for giving us the time this morning to record.
Pleasure.
And we would love to have you back at some point because I've got a list of questions. I've got a list of things I wanted to talk about. The Mini Cooper.
Yeah.
You've talked about McLaren, but there's obviously the F430. Tons and tons of things, even through to the X5. But right. We can hopefully organize something in the future. If you've got the time.
Absolutely.
Again.
When we have the watch ready, the first watch to come out, we'll show it to you.
Excellent. Well, listen, thank you guys for coming on the show. Thanks for listening. If you want to find out more about what Frank is up to, you just have to Google his name. Mm-hmm. That is that simple. But definitely check out his YouTube channel. Subscribe to that because it's not just cars of the past. It's not just things he's worked on. I think one of the most recent ones was you were looking at cars in video games and how when you take away reality and you can play with the physics and everything else, what you can get away with.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of different things on there to go and check out. And then another video I liked was the one about your favorite Porsches across the eras through to the, I think it was a 928 was your favorite.
One of my favorites. Yes, absolutely.
One of your favorites. Yes. One of the three. Yeah. Tons and tons to check out. Obviously check out what we're up to as well at Scottish Watches on Instagram, scottishwatches.co.uk. And we're starting to do video again. We've managed to find a little bit of time and we are out there in the populace thanks to lockdown easing here in Scotland. So more video content coming soon. And obviously check out Slack Tadger because he does Loom. Don't you, James?
I'm getting so edited out of this podcast, I'm not even concerned.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and we will catch you again soon.
Perfect. Thank you very much, guys. Cheers.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.